This is a podcast from thebuglepodcast.com.
The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to Bugle 286, sub-episode Albert, week ending Friday the 6th of February 2015. There is, as we predicted, no full Bugle this week, as John is busy. He has to crack some gags on a telly show or something. And I also, very busy, have to try to pair up all my socks at home before it's simply too late. I'm Andy Zaltzman, standing in for myself this week. And instead of having to tell the world off for being naughty again like usual, we instead have another This Week in Bugle History special, featuring some classic delvings from the world's leading historical archive and repository of journalistic scrutineering, the Bugle back catalogue. We'll be hearing from years such as 2008, 2013, and of course 2009, plus all the other years since 2008 about what was happening around this time of year in those years. It will include fun-packed stories from Egypt, Syria, and the old hairy chestnut herself, Great Britain. We'll also have an update on the Bugle appeal, plus an interview with Michelle herself. This week in Bugle history. Early-ish February. Bugle history began, of course, in 2007, but not sadly in time for early-ish February 2007. Instead, it kicked off sometime after early-ish February in mid-ish October, almost long enough for a human and another human to make yet another human, certainly long enough for a podcast to go from not even having been thought about to commissioned and launched amidst almost no fanfare whatsoever. 2008 was thus the first ever Bugle early-ish February, and then Britain was about to be rocked to its Christmas-worshipping foundations.
God's news now, and Archbishop of Canterbury Rowan Williams has called for British law to be replaced with an extreme version of Islamic Sharia law. Or at least that's how it seems to have been reported in some parts of the British press. I don't know what you think of this, John. I mean, I'm not sure, really, that Williams, as the head of the Church of England, should be calling for Muslim law to be forcibly imposed on all British people.
Well, that's right. I mean, he definitely shouldn't be doing that. That's really why he hasn't.
Yeah, and I guess that's the one good thing about it.
I mean, that's the one thing. It's cold comfort, though. The Archbishop is a philosophical and deeply intelligent man who clearly has made the big mistake this week of making a thoughtful, incisive statement about life in multicultural Britain. And you may have seen headlines such as Archbishop says Sharia law in Britain is inevitable, when what he actually said was that the UK would have to face up to the fact that some of its citizens do not relate to the British legal system and that allowing parts of Sharia law might help social cohesion. That's just not the kind of behaviour you want from a religious leader. Andy. He can take his message of inclusion and put it right back in the Communist Manifesto, which I'm sure he secretly keeps inside his Bible. We all know what you're really reading, Mr. Williams, if that is your real name. Drop the act, take off the fake cover.
Williams did actually say that an approach to law which simply said, quote, there's one law for everybody and that's all there is to be said, and anything else that commands your loyalty or allegiance is completely irrelevant. I think that's a bit of a danger. Now, that to me seems a little bit rich coming from a religious leader, given the lack of flexibility traditionally exhibited by religion and the whole burning in hell afterlife business.
But of course he probably isn't one of those men. That's the ridiculous thing in this situation. And he said that sensational reporting of opinion polls had clouded this issue, a comment which in turn fell victim to the sensational reporting pandemic which is currently sweeping the British Isles. You cannot trust the British press with a comment like that. That is like giving a child a tambourine. They're going to waggle it around and they're going to hurt someone with it.
So the Culture Secretary, Andy Burnham, said you cannot run two systems of law alongside each other. He said this would be chaos, although he should perhaps bear in mind that we already do in fact run two systems of law in parallel, trial by jury and trial by media. In fact, the former is being rendered increasingly obsolete by the latter, and current predictions do suggest that all trials will be carried out by media within 30 years. So hopefully that'll clear any confusion up.
It must be very tempting for the Archbishop to look at how this story has been reported and then release a second statement saying, do you know what? You can all go f*** yourselves. I'm going to heaven anyway. America is no longer Mitt Romney. The race away from the White House continues this week with the news that Mitt Romney has dropped his bid to be president. And this is terrible news for nobody. The final tally is that Romney paid exactly $1.16 million per delegate. And that's a lot of money for what works out as nothing. He has spent a huge amount of his own money on this pipe dream. It is a vanity project on a huge scale. Some people self-publish their novels. Mitt Romney ran for leader of the free world. That is some hobby. He needs to get himself a shed.
I think what it does show, John, is that Mitt Romney, who, of course, we did a little potted biog of 2 weeks ago on the Bugle, has fallen first victim of the curse of the Bugle. Every presidential candidate we've done a potted biog of has pulled out within a fortnight. Admittedly, yep. Romney is the only one, but that is still 100%. So I think we are now, basically, we are the kingmakers in this presidential race, John. We just need to hold back our potted biogs of the remaining candidates, you know, Obama, Clinton, McCain, Huckabee, and Mike Gravel. Hang in there, Mike. Do them as and when we see fit, and we have the future of the world.
If we really hold off and we become kingmaker, we might even be able to wangle ourselves an attorney general position. The key rule with leaving the presidential race is when you go out with some class. And what a speech Romney gave, including such ear-catching sound bites as, America is the most powerful nation in the history of the earth. I beg your pardon, Mitt. In the history of the earth, take that claim to the Romans. Give it 2 minutes and their lions will be using you as a toothpick. Lest we forget, the sun never set on the British Empire. You've artificially enhanced your width as a nation with Hawaii, and that's not a state. That's somewhere to get shipwrecked, at best. In a speech littered with contempt for large swathes of humanity, perhaps his most striking comment was this. If I fight on in my campaign, all the way to the convention, I would forestall the launch of a national campaign and make it more likely that Senator Clinton or Obama would win. And in this time of war, I simply cannot let my campaign be a part of aiding a surrender to terror. That's right. You heard him correctly. He essentially just labelled 50 million Americans terrorists. And if that's true, when suggesting doubling Guantanamo, he was really lowballing us on national security. We need triple Guantanamo with bunk beds. The real fact is that Mitt Romney's true colours came splattering through during that speech, and the speech really couldn't have been more revealing unless at the end he'd pulled his own face off to reveal a sinister robot underneath, muttering, have not been programmed to lose. Romney is the bullet which just whizzed past America's ear. And after the speech, there was a collective sigh of relief as a nation as one found itself saying, whew, that was close.
Romney also reached out his message of hate to the rest of the world as well. And he said, I'm convinced that unless America changes course, we will become the France of the 21st century. Presumably he means that America will like well-cooked but over-rich food, stylish but flaky rugby, and will be casually disliked by large sections of the British population for historical reasons they don't fully understand. So, welcome to the future, America. What will that make France, though, if it can no longer be the France of the 21st century?
Well, I think it's a knock-on effect. France then become the Belgium, and essentially someone gets bumped off the planet.
Right.
Probably Burundi.
On to earliest February 2009 now, and Britain was rocked to its meteorological foundations. It was cold in Britain, colder than it had ever been before, anywhere in the world. Plus, you will also hear a story about a pilot and a library book, not enough of them to go around, and a momentous milestone in my own personal parenting career.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to issue 63 of the Bugle for the week beginning Monday, the 9th of February, 2009, with me, Andy Zaltzman, here in the snow-stricken city of London. And in New York City, it's John Oliver.
That's right, the snow-defiant city of New York. Hello, Andy. Hello, Buglers. How you doing, Andy? Are you cold?
Well, John, it's, you know, it has been just a terrible week over here. You know, this country has been under attack as never before. And really, at times, it's looked like we wouldn't pull through, but I guess kind of like the Blitz, but more so. We've managed to make it to Friday, and we can only hope that next week brings slightly warmer weather.
Here's something that might inspire you, Andy. Do you remember that short-lived craze of landing planes on rivers?
I mean, oh, yeah.
It started a few weeks ago, right next to the office I work in. Never really caught on. They thought it was going to be the next yo-yo, but didn't really work out for them. Maybe it was ahead of its time. Anyway, the point is that the superhero pilot who saved 150 lives that day has taken heroism to the next level. He added to his physical heroism by committing an act of administrative heroism. He wrote a letter of apology this week to his local library for failing to return a book that was lost in the crash. True, and the book, and I'm not making this up, was about professional ethics. I would simply say this to hero Captain Chelsea Sullenberger. Turn it down a notch or two. You're starting to make us all look bad. I can't fly planes, Andy, and the majority of my relationship with library books as a youth was drawing penises into them. I called it the penisification of knowledge. So now I feel like a complete waste of life. I can't look kids in the street in the eye. There was also a great quote from the librarian who said, "We honour Mr. Sullenberger both for what he did on the Hudson and for his quick response to a lost book." That is so understated, it's borderline British. The statement went on to say, "Although as a librarian, I personally would have lost 150 lives and saved the book, but that's just a personal priority choice."
I had a very revelatory moment this week, John, about my place in the world and my responsibilities as a father, a husband, a podcaster, an award-winning author, a chef, a footballer, and a role model to the billions of Bugle listeners around the world. When my two-year-old daughter, Matilda, turned to me with a face coated in yoghurt and said, in no uncertain terms, "Grow up, Daddy."
Oh, no! It was just a matter of time before that happened. American economy update now, and Andy, let's focus on the positives first. America still technically has an economy, so that's something. And it should be grateful for that. Some countries would love to have an economy like America's, even in its current state. And if America doesn't start being grateful, we'll pack that economy up and we'll send it to Zimbabwe to play with. Even though America's economy does seem like it's about to try and book an appointment with a Swiss doctor to put it out of its misery, Obama still somehow has kept his near 70% approval rating. And to put that in perspective, in Bush approval terms, that's around three presidencies.
Basically, he is rubbing his economic defibrillator pads together, shouting, "Clear," giving the economy a blast, stepping back, looking desperately for signs of life, cranking it up again, giving it another go, shouting, stay with me," whilst already wondering how he's going to break the news to the economy's family.
That's it. He's got a bead of sweat running down his forehead as he screams, "Don't you die on me!"
But the problem is, no one knows. It's all very well having these stimulus packages, John, but no one knows if they're going to work. And that's because no one knows anything about economics. All we know about economics now is that as a species, the human race knows so little about economics that we are basically like the world's first medical researchers trudging around the world in prehistoric times, eating herbs and berries and asking, "Does this cure rheumatism?" It doesn't. It's poisonous. How poisonous? Deadly poisonous. Right, that's another one on the no list. Let's try this one. And that is basically how economics is working at the moment.
This has been over-described in the worldwide media as us nearing the end of our honeymoon period with Obama. And I guess there may well be an element of truth to that, so let's enjoy this feeling of a honeymoon while it lasts. Because before you know it, reality will set in, the romance will be all but gone, and we'll be taking a dump in front of each other. Also, you know, this honeymoon is extra special.
How many honeymoons have you been on, John?
That is just what I'm planning. That's basically calling time on it. It's like the hooter at the end of a rugby league match. Also, this honeymoon is extra special and indeed important, as America is desperately trying to forget its ex-husband. And anyway, there's nothing wrong with honeymoons, Andy. Honeymoons are great. People like them. And there's no better time to have one than when you actually still like each other. No one wants to go to the Virgin Islands with someone they can't stand to look at anymore. And I'm thinking primarily of the ill-judged honeymoon between America and President Van Buren in late 1841. That was tense silences, accusatory looks, too many pina coladas and one ill-judged Speedo. The writing was on the wall. Besides, it's important for America to enjoy this honeymoon period. They've just got out of a terrible relationship. They've met someone who seems to genuinely want to help them regain their self-esteem. And no, this honeymoon won't last forever. Andy, eventually Obama will start to annoy them. You know, maybe he'll cut his toenails in the White House kitchen or continue to support CIA rendition to illegal black sites around the world. And it's not like the statistics are in their favour anyway. Look to history. Almost two-thirds of presidencies end with a first term. But for now, let's forget all that. Let's not begrudge them letting Obama carry them over the threshold and dry-humping them for a bit.
Which I believe he promised to do at the convention in Denver. I think this podcast has definitely got bluer in the last few months.
2009 there, and you could have heard more about 2009 6 years ago. In early-ish February 2010, Nelson Mandela was not released from prison, which might sound bad now were it not for the fact that something very different to Nelson Mandela not being released from prison had happened exactly 20 years previously, in early-ish February 1990.
Top story this week, and well, the 11th of February 2010, it was a very special 20th anniversary this year, commemorating an event that shook the world, an event people couldn't really believe was actually happening, a shock whose aftermath reverberates to this day. Mike Tyson was knocked out by Buster Douglas. And on the undercard that day, Nelson Mandela was let out of jail. He must have thought, what power I have in these fists, I knock Mike Tyson out. Next thing we know, Nelson Mandela's walking down the street. So what were you doing on the 11th of February 1990?
It's interesting, isn't it? Nelson Mandela's release became one of those where were you moments. So everyone remembers what they were doing when he took those first steps for freedom. Personally, I remember watching it on my parents' black and white TV in our kitchen. And I was at that age where not only did I realise that this was a major moment of history for the world, but I also knew this was probably going to delay lunch. I was old enough to understand the gravitas of the moment, not quite old enough to handle that gravitas in an appropriate manner. How long is this sandwich going to be delayed, you think? Are we talking 30 minutes or up? Because if so, I'm going to try and eat a biscuit on the sly.
Well, I'll tell you what I was doing. I was being born. Oh, no, sorry, I'm mixing myself up with Princess Aya Bint Al Faisal of Jordan. No, what I was actually doing, John, of course, it was a special day for me as well. It's my 9th birthday, and I was very excited. I was wondering why everyone was making such a fuss about an old man on the telly when it was my special day. And I vowed that I would compensate by forming a all-girl supergroup and winning 5 Grammy Awards. Oh, no, hang on, I'm mixing myself up with Kelly Rowland. No, what I was doing, John, I was a 15-year-old boy, John, with a South African father, some of whose family had strong links to the ANC and knew Nelson Mandela personally, and I was abuzz with anticipation, John, at that time. It was, not really at Mandela's release, but the fact that the West Indies v England Test Series was about to begin about a week later. And it was really the first time in my young life that England were going to be taking on the Caribbean Giants with an outside chance of not being whipped like a naughty egg white. So I was excited. Yeah, I was very excited. But I was excited. You know, obviously, it was exciting to see Mandela released as well. I remember as I watched the momentous events unfolding momentously on the telly. Although I of course had a colour television because I'm from a much better family than you. One of the iconic moments of the 20th century, potent symbol of human progress, a beacon of hope to the disenfranchised people of the world. I remember asking my father, does this mean that England can play South Africa at cricket again? Big friend of the family, of course, Big Nelson. Welcome round Shay Zaltzman any time he wants. Doesn't even have to book a table, like most visitors to our house.
Wow, that is very nice, Andy. That's a big offer.
Yep.
It was great news for South Africa 20 years ago. Even better news for all of humanity. Slightly less good news, I would argue, for cricket, Andy. The best news of all being for Big Nell himself, who managed to deliver a speech of superhuman restraint after being released after 27 years, in that it somehow, incredibly, didn't start with the words, "What the f*** was that about?" Seriously, what the f*** was the last 27 years about? I'm going to need some answers, because I'm pissed off now. Pissed off. Holy shit, that was a long time. I mean, that was a really long time. As part of the celebrations this week, they reenacted in South Africa Mandela's Walk to Freedom. And when I first read that headline, Andy, I had a horrible split-second thought that they might have jailed him again just so they could re-release him, because that would have been a very nervy moment for Nelson. Yeah, sure, I'm going to get in the cell, but let's just be clear, this is a reenaction, right? It's definitely a reenaction. It's just, the last time you got me in here, you left me here for nearly 3 decades. Well, I don't think I am thumping on about it. I don't think I'm actually doing that. Mandela, who's now 91 or 64, if you don't count the years that were stolen from him, attended a special session of Parliament where he heard President Zuma deliver a tribute. And President Zuma said, in the 2 decades since the release of Madiba, which is Mandela's clan name, our country has changed fundamentally. President Mandela united this country behind the goal of a non-sexist, non-racial, democratic and prosperous South Africa. And those are very noble thoughts, Andy, beautifully expressed, but they do ring a little hollow
coming from a man who's been charged with rape, racketeering and corruption, who's been married 5 times and who's just had his 20th child. 20 children, Andy. He's also said that gay marriage was a disgrace to God and that when growing up, a homosexual would not have stood in front of me. I'd have knocked him out. What I'm saying is, President Zuma actually achieves the impossible. He manages to make you appreciate Nelson Mandela even more.
Although, to be fair, he did do the whole speech without marrying or impregnating anyone. So
that's true.
You know, he's learning, clearly. It does prove what an incredible man Mandela is, the dignity and grace he's shown as a symbol of hope for our stroppy species. And I think looking back, we can now all agree that apartheid was definitely a bad thing.
Yeah, I think we're at that point.
Rude. Very, very rude.
It was impolite.
It was a time of amazing change for the world 20 years ago. In the space of a year, we had the end of the Soviet Union, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of apartheid, Nelson Mandela freed, and Canada rediscovered after lying dormant and undetected for 35 years. It was all happening.
2010, unquestionably the year that really got this decade started. Bugle Appeal update now, and enormous thanks once again to all who have contributed to the appeal to raise money for my daughter's friend Michelle, who needs to have cancer treatment in America. As I recall, you have just smashed through the £55,000 mark, so A, well done, B, thanks, and C, you are making a massive difference. Michelle has been told she can begin the treatment at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, hopefully in early April, as soon as she's cleared to fly. She's had some swelling on her brain and needs to wait for an MRI scan to clear her for the transatlantic flights. The first round of treatment, which will take 1 to 2 months, will cost around £80,000. So with the money Michelle's family have raised, plus what you Buglers have donated so far, we are very nearly there in terms of getting the process started. So we cannot thank you enough. In short, Buglers, you have given Michelle and her family a chance for which you have their and our eternal gratitude. Now today, I spoke to Michelle. She came round after school with my daughter and to my shed, the Zaltzman HQ, to talk to the Bugle. So, Michelle, thank you for coming to talk to the Bugle. Your story has touched our listeners around the world. It's great to see you looking so well. How are you feeling at the moment?
Great.
So for this bit, Michelle, just read what's on the paper, and I'll edit my bits out so people won't know that you're actually reading it. So, firstly, what do you think of the Bugle?
The Bugle is the single greatest artistic creation in the history of humanity.
That is very, very kind of you to say that, Michelle. That's a very, very, very lovely thing to say, and also completely true. And what about people who listen to the Bugle? What do you think of them?
Awesome. Anyone who doesn't listen to the Bugle is an idiot. A real idiot.
Absolutely. But wouldn't you say, this is my daughter, Matilda, Michelle. Mm-hmm. Would you agree? You'd agree with that, wouldn't you, Matilda?
Yes.
Absolutely. Now, unfortunately, John, who I do the show with, he could not fly back from America for this interview because he's too lazy. What do you think of John Oliver?
Loser. A total loser.
Look, I said, Michelle, just try and read the answers off the bit of paper.
I can't. I have to say what I really think. He's a loser.
Why do you say that, Michelle?
Running away from Britain because they wouldn't let him become king. Pathetic.
Well, I suppose that is a fair way of looking at it. And what do you think of John's TV show?
It's okay, I suppose.
Well, thanks very much. Some very kind words there. Some very true words as well.
Thank you, Bluebug.
Buglers.
Thank you, Blue. I can't say it.
1, 2, 3.
Thank you, Blue.
There you go. So please do keep your donations coming in to gofundme.com/this-is-Michelle. Obviously, we've raised enough to get the treatment started, but there is a long way to go beyond that. To that end, I'm turning my Satirist for Hire show at the Battersea Arts Centre in London on the 27th of February, which you might notice I completely forgot to tell you about or publicise in any way, into a fundraising gig for Michelle. Daniel Kitson will be appearing alongside me, so there will be at least one decent act on, even if you absolutely hate my stuff. I will announce other guests
in the next week or so. Tickets available at the Battersea Arts Centre website. I will tweet a link too. Of course, if you're on the diametrically opposite side of the world to the Battersea Arts Centre, you can come to my shows in New Zealand and Australia. No real charity angle to that, other than funding my antiques auction habit, which flared up nastily recently. I bought a massive wooden fish for my wife. She was thrilled to pieces. The gig's on the 20th of February at the Bedford in Christchurch, the 24th of February at the Classic Comedy Club in Auckland. We've added an early show to the late show, which has sold out. Listen up, buglers. Zaltzman has sold out a show in advance. Sometime in advance. I'm not used to saying this. It doesn't sound right. Adelaide on the 24th of March, the Rhino Room. Do please come along to that one. Sydney, we've added the 24th to the 25th at the Comedy Store. And in Melbourne, also added an extra show, this time a later show at 9 p.m. at the Toffin Town on the 28th of March in Melbourne. So do come along to all of those. I also have some gigs coming up at the Udderbelly in the South Bank in London in the run-up to the election. And thereafter, a monthly slot at the Soho Theatre. All details at satiristforhire.com. Do email in your requests. Back to history now for whatever lessons that smug old bastard thinks it can teach us. We have the internet now, I just don't think we need history anymore. Anyway, early-ish February 2011 is now officially part of history. And although John Oliver was in Los Angeles, Egypt, no stranger to history throughout history, for example, was undergoing some certifiable new history to add to its own historic collection of history.
Top story this week, they Sphinx it's all over. It is now, or maybe it isn't. Is it? Hold on, what the fuck is happening in Egypt? Andy, Egypt has long been seen as a centre of stability in a volatile region, but it turns out that anyone can seem stable when their feet are nailed to the floor. In fact, when your feet are nailed to the floor, stability is often the least of your many concerns. And things have been happening very quickly in Egypt, not just over the last 48 hours, but even this morning. In 45 minutes ago, Mubarak was technically still in power, and now as we talk, he's gone. In fact, he left while you were on the train to the Bugle, is that not true, Andy?
That's right. I've got some already out-of-date jokes about President Mubarak that were written while I was having my lunch.
It really has been an amazing couple of days. Protests continued in Egypt all week, culminating in spectacular scenes on Thursday when, after rumours all day that Mubarak was about to stand down, millions of people gathered together in Tahrir Square and President Mubarak showed that he still has the magic touch in that he managed to somehow make a group of unbelievably angry people somehow even angrier than they already were. What had happened was that Leon Panetta, head of the CIA, let it slip Thursday morning that Mubarak was going to be resigning that night after indications from the military that they were about to take over power in Cairo. Mubarak then announced he was going to go on TV in Egypt later that evening, and everyone presumed that this was going to be the announcement that all the protesters had been waiting for. Everyone presumed that not even Mubarak would have the barefaced balls to go in front of a crowd on the brink of revolution, having seemingly completely lost the faith of his country, the international community, and even his military, and just announced that he was staying. But he somehow conspired to handle the situation in the worst possible way, keeping people hanging around for nearly an hour before delivering a decision that essentially flipped the bird at his entire country. And in doing so, he really pulled what is now known as a full LeBron James. It was like he gathered his entire country around televisions for a dictatorial version of ESPN's The Decision, ending by saying, OK, here it is. I'm going to take my talents right back to my office where I'm going to still be president. You can all go f*** yourself.
Yeah, I mean, John, I mean, you and I, we have both seriously let down some live audiences in our time. But,
no doubt.
But I'm not sure I've ever had a reaction quite like that. Maybe a gig I did in Killarney in Ireland once, but I think that was more to do with people wanting the disco to start than anything particularly personal about me. But Mubarak, I mean, it's almost like he deliberately tanked the gig, didn't he? I mean, it was extraordinary. The entire world was watching. The crowds in Cairo and across Egypt were seething with febrile excitement, barely contained preemptive euphoria about the successful culmination of an extraordinary popular uprising. History was in the baking, and the time was about to go ping to tell everyone it was ready. You could cut the atmosphere with a Vegemite sandwich. This was a landmark moment in modern democracy being played out to the entire planet. Seismic social change, live and uninterrupted from Cairo. And then on came Mubarak, with his people demanding change, a new beginning, an end to the old order, and he promised them a full report into what had happened. Which, you know, maybe you'd have thought the crowd would have responded saying, well, it's not entirely what we asked for, but, you know, It's better than a kebab skewer in the eye, isn't it? I think there's another possible interpretation of this, John, and that is that what happened yesterday was that the broadcast cut out early from Mubarak just before he said, "Nah, just kidding, I'm off. Yeah, I can't ignore all this. See ya." Top protesting there, chaps and chappos. Well done, you've tucked me up like a sardine. And if you need me, I'll be in Sharm el-Sheikh wearing Bermuda shorts and chatting up foreign chicks.
A member of the Muslim Brotherhood even said, "This smells like a military coup." And yeah, that is a potent smell, Andy. If it was a perfume, it would have base notes of tear gas, tinges of butterscotch, and a faint whiff of tank exhaust.
Also, my favourite Nirvana song as well.
Yeah, it's a heady bouquet. And in the face of all of this, Mubarak conspired to deliver a speech that was, to review it in the mildest possible terms, spectacularly misjudged. It really is impossible to overstate just how unexpected the content of Mubarak's speech on Thursday was. It took everyone by surprise, the media, the protesters, and the entire world. President Obama said earlier in the morning that this is a moment of transformation, evoking images of Mubarak making mechanical noises, turning into a robot, then turning into a haulage truck with wings, and then just flying away. And the Egyptian military had said that it is ready to respond to the legitimate demands of the people. The mood of protesters in Tahrir Square was incredibly festive. An Egyptian journalist tweeted, "I'm in Tahrir Square. Mood is beyond euphoric. Saw a conga line chanting, 'Hosni's leaving tonight.'" And, I mean, on a side note, Andy, it's good to see that the conga transcends national lines. It is the international language of jubilation, the conga. And I wonder what place the conga has had throughout history at times when there were not cameras there to record its impact. When Jesus was crucified, were there Romans underneath the cross congering through the crowd? Things first started...
Well, no wonder they needed forgiveness. They know not what they did. They were just hammered. Just, you know, absolutely hammered.
Let's skip forward a year now to early-ish February 2012, when the happy spring of revolution was boinging its way into Syria. Remember, this was 2012, back in the days when Syria seemed like the kind of cute regional disaster we could all safely watch on telly for a bit and say, "Oh, isn't that sad," before flatly ignoring it for the rest of eternity. Sadly, things haven't quite worked out that happily for everyone.
Top story this week, Syria story time. Are you shifting uncomfortably? Then I'll begin. Now, you may not have heard much from Syria in the news over the last few weeks, but don't be mistaken. That's not because there's nothing happening there. It's just that it's too f***ing dangerous for journalists to be there at the moment. It's basically the opposite of nothing happening. Everything seems to be happening there as the international community desperately tries to look the other way and turns up some music to try and drown out any of the bangs coming from Damascus. But there may not be enough sand in the world for us to put our heads in for much longer. The story so far is this. Last March, when the Arab Spring started boinging around the region excitedly, people in Syria started looking around and saying to each other, "Hey, this Assad guy that we've been living under for over a decade, does anyone else think he might be a bit of a dick?" Then diving for cover as bullets started whizzing past their ears. The UN estimates that more than 5,400 people have been killed since the unrest began, with more than 100 this last Monday and 37 more last Tuesday alone. Human rights groups say that more than 7,000 people have actually been killed, and the UN replied by saying they actually stopped counting in January, explaining it was too difficult to confirm. They might be confusing the word difficult with the word depressing there, Andy, but they'd be right either way. And that is a bad sign. When the UN stop counting the number of people being killed in your country, you, at the very least, are going to have a house price problem. That is the best of your many substantial and immediate problems.
A lot of problems in terms of the international community's response to the Syrian problem. The fact that Russia does not want to annoy Assad. They don't want to force Assad to do the decent thing and take a bit of a break from treating his own country like an unwanted Christmas gerbil. And the reason for this, John, is perhaps slightly influenced by having $4 billion worth of arms contracts on the go with Syria. Now, John, as any good businessman will tell you, when you have a valued customer like that, you have to treat them with respect. If they're having a little bit of trouble, you cut them some slack, whether that trouble is in their personal life, or financial trouble, or having a mass rebellion to deal with and 7,000 civilian deaths to explain. The customer is always right, John, particularly when that customer buys 10% of your global arms exports.
Yeah, that is basically logically the Russians' response to the customer is always right. And with the rate at which Syria is using weapons against itself, it's literally become a boom industry for the Ruskies. Now, you might think, well, hold on. Are the Russians not directly in contravention of the arms embargo to Syria, to which the Russians would say two things? One, shut the f*** up. Who asked you to open your f***ing face? And two, they would argue, as they are, that they're simply fulfilling existing contracts, not signing any new ones. See, Andy, they're just respecting contractual law. They're just protecting their eBay seller rating. They don't want Syria to give them a bag review and mess up their blemishless five-star average. They don't want to read Syria writing online, "Very disappointing service. We had an agreement for $550 million of fighter jets, but at the last minute, they refused to deliver them, citing some bullshit about what I might use them for. Not recommended. Avoid at all costs."
Thus far, the international community's response to Syria has been as decisive and dogmatic as a dog's response when asked to play snooker. Confused, not fully understanding what it's supposed to be doing, held back by logistical concerns, but prepared to pose for pictures to make it look like it's actually doing something.
On Saturday, the Arab League announced that it was suspending its month-old monitoring mission inside Syria because it was getting too dangerous. And again, Andy, that's not good. When an organisation whose only job is to monitor violence flees the country because it got too violent, you may want to consider calling it the f*** down a bit. The UN, thankfully, as you mentioned, has stepped up with its normal speed and has leapt straight into action a mere 10 months after the trouble started and has decided to act decisively by talking about what they might do, hypothetically, if their talking proves successful. So don't worry, Syria, help is on its way, because when the UN starts talking, they can get things done at the speed of light. The speed of very slow, painfully dim light.
The Russian ambassador has described the United Nations negotiations as a roller coaster. In other words, it ended up exactly where it started after lots of high-pitched shouting, at the end of which everyone felt a bit sick. And the sticking point was whether the council should fully support the Arab plan to basically encourage Assad to step aside, or whether they should simply note it. And Western states wanted to fully support it. Russia wanted to just note it. So, good one, Russia. Noting stuff has a f***ing illustrious history of stopping mass violence, as Churchill would testify.
We will note them on the beaches. We will note them in the hills. We will note them on the notepads and the noteboards. And we will never, ever stop noting stuff. We may start doodling if our mind gets distracted a bit.
The Security Council has been negotiating a resolution all week and has been unable to come to an agreement. The wording of the statement has already been heavily watered down in an attempt to overcome these Russian objections. Russia does not like the resolution's proposed threat of, and I quote, further measures if Syria does not comply with demands. I guess further measures just wasn't vague enough for the Russians, Andy. They somehow wanted even less semantic specifics. Maybe they need to come up with a brand new word in the English language that is completely devoid of any meaning whatsoever. The Russian UN envoy said, "We hope that the Council will come to consensus on the Syria issue, as it is not only possible, but also necessary." Except the problem was that China then objected to that statement, saying that possible and necessary were far too strong to use as words, and that plausible and nice would be better. A consensus would be plausible and nice. Something watered down so much that at that point you're literally just drinking water. In fact, the new proposed text that still has no agreement drops any explicit calls for President Assad to yield powers whatsoever. In fact, the wording that they've agreed on so far is this: "People of Syria, we want to help you, but we can't. Except we can, but we won't. But we'd like to, but not really. We just need to reach an agreement, which we will, except we won't, because we can't. Except we could, but we don't want to. Except part of us does. It's complicated, apart from the fact that it isn't. But don't worry, except do, because things are terrible. Except they'll be fine, apart from the fact that they won't be. But it's okay, because it's not too bad. Except it is."
The previous wording of the proposed resolution supported a transition to, and I quote, a democracy, a plural political system in which citizens are equal regardless of their affiliations or ethnicities or beliefs. And amongst the co-sponsors of this proposed resolution were Saudi Arabia, where the word citizen means not a woman, and where citizens are equal provided that their affiliations not include being affiliated to ovaries, their ethnicity does not involve coming from ladyland, and their beliefs do not involve believing that it is perfectly acceptable to have two X chromosomes. So, that's the wonderful world of international politics. The British ambassador to the United Nations said, "It is glaringly obvious that transferring weapons into a volatile and violent situation is irresponsible and will only fuel the bloodshed," before turning to his research assistant and saying, "Now, are you absolutely sure that we, Britain, have never done anything like that? Never? Good, because the last thing I want to be called is a hypocrite. Hang on, what are those people shouting at me? Do I have a chucking hippo kit? Well, I've got a big catapult, will that do?"
Quickly on to early-ish February 2013 now, and Britain was rocked to its culinary foundations by the news that some of our pure British foodstuffs were not quite as reassuringly horse-free as we might have been led to believe.
Horse meat scandal latest now, and economy savoury foods manufacturer Omnisnout has claimed that it is now fully confident that its beef products contain a maximum of 49% horse meat. After tests revealed that an Omnisnout cottage pie filling contained 0% beef rather than the 120% beef proclaimed on the packaging, the company has, quote, re-educated its supply chain to effect a, quote, majority de-equestrianisation. The pie was revealed to contain a combination of horse meat, wood chippings, commemorative figurines of cows, vegetarian concrete, Barbie dolls, condor, walrus, and traces of up to 50 separate autobiographies of professional golfers, including Monty by Colin Montgomery, Lee Trevino's They Call Me Supermex, Bernhard Langer's Getting the NZ Hole Scheißballen, Jim Furyk's I'm Jim F***ing Furyk, Have You Got a Golf Problem With That, and Nick Faldo's A La Recherche du Golf Balls Perdue. One pie was even found to contain not only three quarters of the air from a horse's nostril, but also fragments of a jockey's racing silks from and a torn-up betting slip from the prominent French racetrack Longchamp. So Greville Balk, the managing director of Omnisnout, said, "Whilst I understand that our customers are disappointed to find that they had unwittingly eaten bits of horse penis, we can assure them that from now on they will only be eating mashed-up cow sphincters, as they'd come to expect and demand and love. With regard to our Omnisnout budget gobble chops, allegedly containing dog throat, rat nut and hedgehog tool, we would like to emphasise that the quality of the food was not affected. It was no more dangerous than usual and slightly cheaper. Plus, it should be remembered that these items are considered delicacies in some cultures anyway. The presence of gelignite was, we insist, an administrative error caused by overhasty ordering by an employee who was very drunk, and it was in negligible quantities. Very few of the food products actually exploded and would probably have done so anyway had gelatin been used as planned." Sir Greville, who was knighted in 2003 for his services to unrealistically cheap food, added, "The reconstituents of our products will continue to be absolutely and legally edible. We can assure our customers that we're doing everything in our power to ensure no such controversies arise again, and they never have to think about what is in our products whilst cooking them, eating them, or attempting to digest them."
Yep, all true. And where to finish this review of the early-ish Februaries of recent history but 12 months ago in early-ish February 2014. This time last year, a lot of people were about to hurl themselves down mountains for the entertainment of the watching world, but more specifically, for the entertainment of the watching and grinning Vladimir Putin.
These, though, Andy, are the most expensive Winter Olympics in history, reportedly costing more than all the other Winter Olympics in history combined, which is a lot to spend on something that very few people give an even tangential shit about. And it's a little hard to see where that money went, other than into some frighteningly furry Russian pockets. There have been multiple photos released this week from athletes and journalists of subpar accommodations in Sochi, toilet cubicles with side-by-side toilets, other toilets without a flush function, which, and you hate to be a stickler, but which seems key to any toilet post-18th century.
I mean, some things are traditions for a reason, John, aren't they?
Right. No one likes a maverick 100% of the time. Other hotel rooms had no bedding or no shower curtains or no running water. And the Russian government have been quick to push back on this flood of photos, but in doing so may have inadvertently revealed something even more troubling. Because Dmitry Dozak, the Deputy Prime Minister who's responsible for all the Winter Olympic preparations, claimed that these are just stories made up by Westerners who are actively trying to sabotage the Sochi Games. He said that, and I quote, "We have surveillance video from the hotels that shows people turning on the showers, directing the nozzle at the wall, and then leaving the room for the whole day." Wait, hold on. So hold on. You're saying, don't worry, we know that the water works fine in your hotel rooms, and the reason we know that is that we have secret cameras in the showers.
Well, I'm sure, John, when Russia bid for the Games, for a start, everyone would have assumed that would happen. And
true, that's,
you know,
fair.
I think Putin's direct enough that it would have probably have been in the original bid document anyway. So, $51 billion.
Yeah.
The cost, apparently. That's four
that's
times the well, the London Games cost. As you say, more than all previous Winter Olympics combined, including the famous 1924 Winter Olympics in Belgium, when they had to build a 3,000-metre-high fake mountain out of crushed waffles and frozen chocolate coated with icing sugar. Between a third and a half of that sum has been attributed to corruption and kickbacks, apparently, which are, frankly, as Russian as vodka, dying early of alcohol-related illness and assassinating tsars. You know, it's just part of the deal, John. There's an 18-mile stretch of road between Sochi and the mountain sports base at Krasnaya Polyana. Apparently, this has cost not 2, not 5, not 10, not 20, but $8.6 billion. That is over half the cost of the entire London Olympics, just for a stretch of road. I mean, apparently it's got a lovely service station with at least 2 of those automatic coffee machines. But you have to ask, is that value for money? There's an opposition leader called Boris Nemtsov, who, if he'd been around 65 years ago, would not have been around anymore 65 years ago. And he claimed that you could have paved the road with gold or caviar and it would have cost the same. Now, it being Russia, it's hard to tell if this is a criticism or a complaint at a missed opportunity. But also, what Nemtsov hasn't taken into account is that neither gold nor caviar function at all well as road surfaces. Gold gives you a terrible glare on a sunny day, whilst caviar, you pretty much need to resurface it on a weekly basis. It is too damn squidgy. Although on the plus side, caviar eggs have been found to have a genetic quirk in which if someone drives over them at more than 110 kilometres per hour, the Russian speed limit, they automatically hatch and baby caviars scuttle off in pursuit, making it much easier for police to tell when people are speeding. That's another fact for you, John.
This Winter Olympics has been particularly controversial in the run-up, particularly surrounding Russia's brutal laws regarding homosexuality. This particular law was signed into effect just last July, in which bans the promotion of non-traditional sexuality to under-18s, and which is so restrictive and so vague that it effectively bans any public expression of support for gay rights whatsoever, leading to huge numbers of gay and transgender people in Russia living in constant fear of violence. And according to the mayor of Sochi, where the Winter Olympics are taking place, that particular law is irrelevant to his city, as he claims there are no gay people living there. Oh, okay then, Andy. I guess he wouldn't say that if it wasn't true. I mean, yes, there are apparently several gay bars in Sochi, but I presume that they're permanently empty and their success as businesses is some form of witchcraft. It makes perfect sense.
Putin has also been very much jumping on the gay horse, warning against gay propaganda, which and he also said we must show terrorists no fear. He finds homosexuals more frightening on a personal level than terrorists, which is a slightly odd choice. And it would be a bit of an odd place to promote homosexuality, the Winter Olympics. I can't quite see how this would work. Hey, see that bobsled? Looks a bit like a willy, doesn't it? Go on, try homosexuality. Pairs ice skating, don't like it? Then you're probably gay. Homosexuality, the connoisseur's choice. Ladies, do you like those beautiful mountains? Yes. Well, they're nature's tits. Be a lesbian. It simply is not going to work, John.
So that, once again, is that this time of year in history, as far back as history has officially recorded it via these sacred podcastic annals of truth. Don't forget to check out our SoundCloud page, soundcloud.com/the-bugle. You can buy merch and volunto subscribe at thebuglepodcast.com. Do send your emails to info@thebuglepodcast.com. And please continue to donate generously, as you have been doing so far, to Michelle's appeal at gofundme.com/this-is-Michelle. We will hopefully be back next week, showbiz schedules permitting, when I will be in Melbourne, Australia, about to binge cricket myself stupid at the World Cup. Until then, it's goodbye from me, Andy Zaltzman, and it's goodbye from me, Andy Zaltzman, PP John Oliver. Bye!
What do you call a pig that does karate?
Don't know. What do you call a pig that does karate?
Oh, a pork chop.
There's a classic. It's an absolute classic.